This is Andrew Cate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon bring their travelogue adventures to a close in the trip to Greece. Jean Desjardins falls in love with a jacket in deerskin. And Welcome to Chechnya explores LGBTQ plus activism in a dangerous place. We'll also answer the question of what film we would wipe from existence.
It's going to be a blast. But just want, before we get like too far into anything, I just want to apologize for the delay in getting to these movies on my part. It's grad school. What the hell else can I say? But we're going to start with the fourth entry in a series that we reviewed the third film of on the first episode of this podcast. Sorry, I had to get my number straight there. Michael Winterbottom's The Trip to Greece, although it's really hard to say if it's Michael Winterbottom so much as it is Rob Brydon and Steve Coogan. For those of you who are somehow unfamiliar with this series, it's been going on since 2010, 2011, I believe. It's basically they play themselves. It's mostly improv. It's just they're following, you know, two rich guys going to a bunch of fancy restaurants in beautiful places. And they're just shooting the shit and they're doing impressions and making each other laugh and learning about ancient history. And it's fun and it's a comfort movie. He's consistently very funny. The two are very charming and self-effacing. Steve Coogan is always kind of poking fun at himself for being an asshole. But, you know, this film, I've appreciated how each film in the series has kind of differentiated itself. Like, for instance, the third one kind of ended on just an absolute wild swing for the fence that was just almost dismissed out of hand. Just like one throwaway line. It's explained in this movie. And it's kind of funny because the way that this film eventually, you know, there's a scene early on in the film in which that kind of sets the tone for where the film is going to go, where basically Steve Coogan runs into an extra that he worked on a movie with while they're in Greece. And this extra asks for a ride to a refugee camp where he is currently staying. And it just becomes kind of a somber moment in what was, you know, kind of a playful lead up to that. And it was playful leading up to it, even though they're, you know, where they're driving. But, you know, there's an undercurrent of Steve Coogan's father about to pass away, too. So, you know, there are these weird dream sequences that, you know, just seem uncharacteristic for the series. But again, it's, you know, it's a nice change of pace for a series that, you know, the movies can get a little long in the tooth at times. So, you know, we have some of these dream sequences where we see Steve Coogan's anxieties about his, you know, his father dying, about how his relationship fell apart, where, you know, you see him reenacting the Iliad. And then you see him in the underground caves. And it's just like there's some interesting stuff in here that hasn't been present in the series. And it ends on a really, really down note that maybe it's just that I'm getting older, too. And as I get more into my adult life, these movies hit in a different way than when the first one came out. But, you know, this actually had some impact on me. And I was just kind of surprised by that. And obviously, there are so many great bits in here. And I don't want to rehash all those because I know you're going to be the one to dissect that part for me. But, you know, like I said, this is just it's a comfort movie. And it's still just kind of a blast to hang out with these guys and just, you know, just be a part of that world and visit places that I will likely never be able to afford to see. But, you know, more than anything, it just makes me want to go out. Like, Andrew, why have we not gone and I know we went to Bonnaroo once, but why have we not gone and done like a trip of this kind of majesty before?
Probably money.
I mean, yes. besides that.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to do it. And I know you're a foodie and I know you'd get a kick out of doing this stuff. So, and I just love going to random places. So I'd love to, you know, my dream is to one day finally go to Amsterdam, you know, or Tokyo, obviously that's my big one, you know, for sure. But those are my two ones. So obviously it'd be a blast, but it's funny you mention that because, you know, my first note here I have written, and I watched this like a month ago, so forgive me if my thoughts are not as fresh in my mind, but my first line I've written here is Coogan and Brydon in vacation porn. Note, this is how you do it, Adam Sandler. So obviously Adam Sandler is known, and obviously, you know, he's done great dramatic work in recent times, but he's known for, you know, creating these projects just so him and his friends can just go off to Hawaii and, you know, get an easy paycheck without putting any effort in. And, you know, I just, you know, I've always just enjoyed this series, you know, and I think you're right in that. How much is it Michael Winterbottom? Sometimes, you know, his films, particularly this series, sometimes he really does just feel like a fly in the wall and just lets these two actors go and play versions of themselves. But I've always really enjoyed their dynamic. I will say, while I like this, and I'm not shocked to hear you say that ending really hit you, and I'll have some thoughts on that in the end. I will say, I think I enjoyed some of the previous entries more. I think just because they were, I think I would say funnier, but also just more of the purely enjoyable, you know, variety. And while I definitely still enjoyed this, and I don't mind like to turn to drama at the end, I did feel like it didn't have the pure enjoyment that some of the other previous entries did. But obviously in this, they're sort of retracing the steps of the Odyssey. And of course, they're going to be, you know, dissecting that in weird comedic bits throughout, you know, some of the, and like you said, I'm going to just mention a few of these bits, you know, because that just hit me. Because at this point, I think this film was released like months ago at this point initially. So it's like weird to even talk about it now. But yeah, it's a series we enjoy. So why the hell not? But one of the early bits that I definitely recalled was the classic, and you'll get the point of this without even having to go anymore, was Stan Laurel and Tom Hardy. which I thought was nice, you know, and obviously with, you know, Steve Coogan actually making a project on Laurel and Hardy, I thought that was a nice touch and a nice, you know, and that's the thing I've always enjoyed about their, you know, repartee, is that they take contemporary, you know, references as well, so they're not alienating the complete, you know, audience. There's also this fun moment where Rob Brydon talks about how he lost a role once to Ray Winstone, which was just so weird. But that's the stuff I really love and appreciate about it. Where obviously the big thing with their dynamic here is that, you know, they're always talking about Rob Brydon as a light entertainer, you know, throughout this series, and Steve Coogan is trying desperately to be taken more serious, although obviously he came to fame as, you know, the very brash comedic character Alan Partridge, so it's really interesting, you know, and I love how they take that and really, you know, use every inch of it. Like, there's even a moment where Damien Chazelle turns Coogan down for a film role. Like, obviously he's not in it, but they reference it, and I thought, oh, and so they're really showing, oh, Steve Coogan is so desperate to be taken seriously in some way. But there's also this great scene, one of my favorite scenes, was when when Rob Brydon was singing Grease from Grease, the musical and film in Grease, and Steve Coogan was just like, oh god, what are you, you're singing Grease in Grease? And there was this great back and forth where they're talking about, how dare you call me a homophone, and it's just like, it was just such a weird thing, you know. And that's what I, like I said, that's what I really enjoy, you know, about this, is even that, you know, bit where they talk about, oh, are we too old to wear a t-shirt with a slogan or logo? I don't, it's just weird stuff that they talk about, classic like middle-aged white guys stuff, but they just, you know, because of their chemistry, I think it really, really, you know, just works. You know, you mentioned those dream fantasy sequences. I thought that was a really interesting touch, you know, for sure. And it certainly helps build, you know, to the final culmination, you know, of the film. And obviously, as you mentioned, you know, there's this plot with essentially, you know, eventually, you know, it's, you know, Steve Coogan has to deal with, you know, death in his family. And what I loved about, you know, how they play these last scenes in the film is that they sort of cut back and forth between a somber Steve Coogan dealing with the death, and then they cut back to Rob and his wife, who joined him on the journey, so they're still abroad. And I thought it really summed up their personalities well, you know, in a really interesting way, and sort of felt, that's why it felt like sort of a fitting conclusion to this series. And what I also loved, there was this really simple moment, but it was like, I think it was like, you know, Rob and his wife were still abroad with Coogan having gone home again, and I loved this scene where I think it's like Rob like and his wife like in bed, and he's still acting the same exact way he acts around Coogan, around his wife, and he's even doing like a Bond impression and stuff. And it was just a simple thing like that that really just struck me. And I thought it was just a great, you know, representation of him, where it's like, it doesn't matter if it's Steve Coogan or his wife, he's still going to be acting the fool and doing these ridiculous impressions. And I just thought something like that, I thought, was really good. And I also loved, there was this conversation that they got to that I thought was really interesting, even on a philosophical level, where they talked about how the driver of the car sometimes assumes higher status, than the passenger. And I thought that was such a weird thing to do, but that's what you sort of come for in these films. You know, obviously they're, you know, they could just go on these trips and just have a camera follow them around and it'd be pretty much the same thing. But I think they really get to some weird debates, you know, about life in general. And that's definitely something, an element of this series that I've definitely enjoyed throughout it.
And I think that one thing that's going to be to the benefit of this movie is that it's probably going to actually, I haven't seen the first two in probably since they've been released, to be honest, but I think I'm kind of overdue to go back and revisit those just to kind of get, now that I actually have the context, a little bit more of where the series is going. So it doesn't, like, I always enjoyed the movies, but they always felt a little aimless in that they weren't necessarily, like, there were, you know, flashes of ideas, like even thinking back to the ending shot of the first one where we kind of feel that sense of loneliness, but it doesn't go to the point that it does in this film. And I know there's probably going to be a fifth one. I honestly thought it was just going to be a trilogy. And honestly, the way that it would have ended with the third film would have been perfectly fine. But whatever. It's just like you said, the chemistry between the two, it's still funny. These movies are easy to get through. But and like I said, even if they do get a little long in the tooth, you're never bored. It's just enjoyable. And even still, the scenery is pretty. But just there's one bit that you did not mention that I want to get to. And this, you know, it seems like this stupid, you know, most simple Saturday Night Live level kind of bit, but just like the impressions that these two do are just so amazing. And there's one moment where they're kind of I'll mention two. There's one where they're doing like dueling Marlon Brando's and The Godfather, just trying to, and you know, Rob Brydon's is a little bit higher pitched and Steve Coogan wants to show him to, like, you know, put a little weight into it. And it's just watching the two of them bounce off of each other and then doing their Dustin Hoffman's career retrospective impressions where they go from The Graduate through the Midnight Cowboy one might actually be my favorite of the whole thing. But, you know, and they go through like Tootsie and just Rain Man. The Rain Man one is fantastic. It's just there's so many like great little bits where you feel like I'm not the kind of guy who goes around like just walking and quoting movies. But this is the kind of movie where I'm a little bit more inclined to do so. And I feel bad about that after always shit talking Austin Powers fans. But, you know, we're all human. This is the kind of movie that just brings it out of me.
Yeah, I mean, I like Austin Powers, for the record. I mean, Goldmember is terrible, but the other two I enjoy. But just one last bit I was going to mention, you know, from this film is they're discussing the Ottoman Empire, and there was this great thing where they were talking about, oh, what is going to be the superhero film that Steve Coogan stars in? And they took from Ottoman, they said he's going to play Otterman or whatever. And that was such a weird, you know, moment. But I don't know. I just love how they take, like, things that are, whether, you know, in the, like, you know, sort of well in the conscious of audiences, and then they just sort of take it in their own sort of weird direction. So I think, you know, we've definitely really enjoyed this series, and I think this is definitely another worthy entry, but it's certainly not going to be, you know, for everyone, and I think this just hits us sort of definitely in the right spot. But with that in mind, I'm sort of going to touch on, you know, a number of news stories before we get to our other films that we're going to be discussing. And I wrote some of these down, you know, a few weeks ago. Some of them I'm just going to touch on briefly, and then we'll get to some of the big sort of breaking news stories from recent times as well. Like, obviously, you know, early in July, we lost great iconic composer Ennio Morricone. You know, obviously, may he rest in peace. And, you know, I just wanted to bring him up because not only, obviously, is he iconic for a lot of his, you know, collaborations with the great Sergio Leone. You know, he obviously scored one of my absolute favorite films of all time in Once Upon a Time in the West. But he also scored, you know, a number of films from, you know, a genre that I touched on a bit in our director's episode a while back. But he directed a lot of films in the giallo genre, and a number of films directed by Dario Argento, like his big breakthrough, The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, as well as The Cat of Nine Tails and Four Flies on Grey Velvet. And, you know, and I loved how he was never, and the thing that I was struck by is I was going through his IMDb before this, and Jesus Christ, like, I couldn't even get to the bottom of it because there was so many credits. There was like 5 to 10 credits every single year, spanning back an insane amount of decades. And I was just like completely, you know, blown away. And obviously he's an icon. So I didn't know if you had any particular memories of Morricone.
You know, it's one of those things where obviously I'm a huge fan of Once Upon a Time in the West. Good God, that movie is something. But it's one, you know, I kind of put him up there in the same breath as John Williams, and just in the way that, like, he creates these themes. And you're thinking of, like, thinking back to his Oscar-winning work on The Hateful Eight. But obviously, even if you don't know the name Ennio Morricone, even if you don't know what movie it's from, you've heard that motif from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I just think that, like, that's an indelible legacy on cinema that really, that's, you know, spoken in the same breath, like I said, John Williams, Hans Zimmer, Alexandre Desplat. I mean, he's one of the all-time greats. And honestly, you can make an argument for him being in the top five. But I went through a phase when I was just out of high school where I just, you know, went through all like the classic. I actually started with Yojimbo just to be on top of things. But then I went through the whole Sergio Leone, you know, the Clint Eastwood trilogy, the Fistful of Dollars or A Few Dollars More, all of it. And it's just, that music is ingrained in my brain. So it's just, you know, the man lived a great life and he left a great legacy. So, you know, we appreciate him.
Definitely, for sure. And then, you know, just a couple other sort of older news stories that I was going to briefly mention. Oh, I forgot to mention to see you, Ryan, before. But, you know, I think I mentioned, you know, in a previous episode that Ryan Gosling was trying to make a Wolfman project, and apparently Lee Whannell is in talks to direct that project. This broke a few weeks back, and obviously he directed The Invisible Man earlier this year and The Great Upgrade that we covered on this podcast as well. And so, you know, when in doubt, if your Universal Monster Universe failed, get a director who actually knows how to direct these things, and, you know, just have him write, make some films. So I'm sure that'll be fine. But I don't think really much more needs to be really said about that. And I was also going to mention that HBO is doing a remake of one of my favorite things ever created in Ingmar Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage, starring Michelle Williams and Oscar Isaac. And now, for those of you that don't know, obviously, Scenes from a Marriage originally aired in, you know, a Swedish TV series, and then was cut down to a 3-hour film edit. But it's one of my favorite things in either format ever made. You know, and apparently this remake is coming from someone who I'm not too familiar with, but apparently he's a co-creator of The Affair, Haggai, if that's how you pronounce it, Levi. So we'll see, you know, how they're able to do it. I know, Ryan, you're not big on this idea, but for me, you know, I don't know. I think because I've been, you know, researching some different things, I think I'm more open to remake culture. And I think just because they have two incredibly strong actors in the roles, we'll see what happens. But yeah, any thoughts on that?
So correct me if I'm wrong, but is The Last House on the Left not technically some kind of adaptation or loosely based on The Virgin Spring?
Yes, you're correct.
Okay, that's what immediately came to my mind. So maybe, yeah, sure, I jumped the gun on that. I'm not expecting something along those lines. But I just, it's a Bergman, that's like, I don't know, it's kind of like remaking something from Orson Welles or, fine, how about this? There's another example. Remember Rob Marshall's Nine, the fucking musical remake of Fellini's 8.5?
Yeah, I didn't watch it, so yeah, I forgot about that, to be honest.
Oh, no, my brother and I, we sat through that garbage, but that, like, this is why I get nervous when these, and I know that, you know, mainstream adult cinema geared towards adults has certainly evolved artistically, and there's a lot more adventurous stuff out there, but, like, I don't necessarily think that anything is going to be as difficult as the films that I just mentioned, but like, I don't know, I don't see it as a recipe for success to even go near, even with the talent attached in the cast. I'm sure they'll be fine, but I just don't, like, it's one of those things that's sacrosanct for me.
Yeah, no, I certainly understand that. And I think it's, you know, and like I said, it's literally one of my favorite things ever created. So, you know, I think, I don't know, I think just at this point, just because there's been so many remakes and so many reimaginings of these things, I think I sort of have like, oh, some of these projects will be good and some of them won't be. And, you know, I think and Luca Guadagnino actually gave a really interesting interview this month. Really interesting. Obviously, he famously remade Suspiria, but also is in the process of doing yet another remake of Scarface. But I thought, like, it was a really interesting interview that I highly recommend reading out, because he sort of gave a completely different perspective on remakes and how he views it as, like, you know, people have been remaking and reimagining things throughout our entire history. And, you know, he views it as an opportunity. He's like, people act like, oh, man, they don't make any new and something new or original. But I don't know. He feels, you know, that it's sort of, you know, you can adapt stories that are different to a modern time that can give new context or a new perspective. So I thought that was an interesting way at coming at it, and obviously It's a Spirit remake, I think, speaks for itself. But with that in mind, you know, I still have a few, just a couple more news stories. I was just going to briefly mention, you know, the 2020 Emmy nominations came out, you know, this week. And of course, you know, people have a lot of hot takes. And, you know, I literally broke my social, like, I haven't posted on social media literally since, you know, like, the only thing I've posted on social media for the past number of months is just episodes of this podcast. So what I ended up, and so I broke that streak because I had to share my thoughts on Rhea Seehorn, the great Rhea Seehorn, who plays the iconic television character Kim Wexler on Better Call Saul. And I had to voice my displeasure with the Emmys once again for overlooking one of the best TV performances of the past number of years. And that's saying something with the amount of quality TV that's going on. So I just had to voice my displeasure with that. And, you know, I sort of did it more tongue-in-cheek. Like, I don't think people should take it that more seriously. But, you know, it is what it is. But I did want to give a shout-out to the show that got the most nominations. And, man, is it deserving. HBO's Watchmen, from the great Damon Lindelof, who has made literally all of his TV series, are among my all-time favorites. So, you know, and this is one that if you haven't seen, you really need to check out, because there has never been a more relevant series to this current time in American history, particularly as it pertains to race. And it's a really crazy and interesting reimagining that completely recontextualizes the original graphic novel and just takes it in a completely different direction. And Regina King is absolutely stunning. And I give him a lot of credit because basically they're saying that that was the only season of it. He doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't really have a good idea and doesn't have an in for another season. And so good, big thanks to him for just sticking to his guns and saying that, you know, the idea hasn't come, so we're not going to just try and continue this on. I think the season speaks for itself, and man, is it something special. And I know you, Ryan, are a big fan of What We Do in the Shadows, and it got nominated, which was pretty shocking. So congrats to you, and it's going to be one of the next things I watch for sure.
You will enjoy it. It actually, I was going through, because I'm a nerd, of course, I have to go through all the technical nominations, and I think it only got in for, like, costume design and sound editing, but it also got three separate writing nominations in the same category for just exceptional episodes, so I'm super happy about that. And I will get on Watchmen. It's just, you know, it's a pain in the ass. I have to wait until midnight to watch anything, to turn off my air conditioner. The air conditioner is right next to the TV speaker, so I'm behind on TV, but I just want to, you know, I'm just going to say it. Disney bought those Mandalorian nominations. I don't give a fuck. That does not belong in the same breath as some of the other stuff that was nominated.
Well, you know, and it's interesting. It's really interesting. And I don't have anything, you know, negative to say too much about it. Like, I enjoyed the show. Is it, like, one of the best things on TV? No. It certainly is not. But I think, you know, I think it's one of those things where in a year where, you know, Game of Thrones is gone and these other big event series are gone, I think it's almost like we should have expected it. You know, we're like, let's, you know, slots into that role. And, you know, like I said, I think, you know, I enjoyed The Mandalorian. I didn't expect it to that degree. But yeah, I'll probably bet that you're probably not too far off when it comes to that, to say the least. But just a couple sort of, we want to touch on the big news stories that have occurred over the past couple weeks. And first, I guess I'll mention that, yes, Tenet has a new release date, yet another. And it seems like this one is actually going to stick. And obviously, there was a lot of concern, apparently, on Christopher Nolan's part that he didn't want to, you know, release, you know, the film, you know, overseas ahead of time in fear of piracy. But they really don't have an option at this point. So apparently, starting on August 26th, they're going to be rolling the film out internationally in different areas. You can find a list of all the different countries that it's going to start to screen. And then it's going to start screening in the U.S. September 3rd. But it's not going to be a complete wide release. And thank God for that, because we know some of these people in some of these states cannot control themselves. So, you know, they're going to be very, they haven't announced exactly what areas are going to be, it's going to be releasing in when exactly. But basically the places who are doing well, you know, with the COVID situation. So it's going to be really interesting experiment, and we'll see what comes of that. But perhaps the biggest news story of the past couple of days is the decision by AMC Theaters and Universal to cut down their theatrical window to 17 days. And essentially what this means is their features must screen theatrically for 3 weekends, and then they have the option of moving a film to VOD, and AMC maybe getting a cut of the profits of you know, the VOD, which is really interesting. And, you know, you can imagine there's a lot of concern from other theater groups. And it's really crazy that it's AMC doing this, because they were literally one of the theater chains who were as resistant as anyone to shrinking the theatrical window. And for those of you that don't know, this has been one of the big topics throughout the industry, you know, throughout the past number of years, because of the rise of streaming services and VOD, and sort of, you know, theaters have never wanted to, and, you know, to shrink the theatrical window. They were already concerned about shrinking it to a few months, and now 17 days is, safe to say, pretty insane.
I would probably just wait. I know Tenet has a new release date. I'll be honest. I'm sorry, Andrew, you're doing that episode alone. I'm still not comfortable going into an old movie theater. I think that not to get too far off course, but we're jamming people into a situation that I don't think we should be putting them in. And obviously we could have been in a completely different place if certain things were done better. And unfortunately, it seems like the rest of the world is a little bit ahead of the game, whereas we are still struggling, and if not even regressing. Yeah, I don't know. Tenet, I'm going to have to wait for VOD on that one. And I'm kind of glad that AMC did make that agreement with Universal, because I feel like that's really one of the only ways that, like, I'm nervous as hell that, you know, when we tongue-in-cheekily refer to it as the death of cinema, that might have accidentally been prophetic. And I worry about that in my worst nightmares, because it's a joy that, as much as I complain about it, I don't necessarily want to lose. And, you know, the idea of the film business is just, like, confusing. And I feel like it's a zero sum game. It's god awful in so many ways. And I don't even necessarily understand the logistics of this deal in terms of dollars and cents and what it means for on the back end. But I see it kind of as a way to at least keep theaters going, and hopefully keep them going until we're on the opposite side of this thing.
Definitely, for sure. And I think, you know, extraordinary times call for, you know, obviously extraordinary measures, but it's going to be really interesting to see what happens, you know, eventually when things, you know, somewhat get back to normal. We can only hope that happens at some point. But it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with that agreement when it comes to that time. But I think it just makes good business sense, you know, for a theater to do this, you know, given the current circumstances and, you know, an unwillingness for audiences to go back into theaters. And honestly, who can blame them? And I certainly do not blame you, Ryan. I'm not saying I'm definitely going, but I assume Tenet is going to be releasing here, you know, in Rhode Island, certainly, you know, ahead of many other areas. So I'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But with that in mind, we can turn our attention to our second film of the day. And boy, have I been waiting to talk about this one. And this is a little film called Deerskin. I assume a film that is not on a lot of people's radar, but this comes from the very unique mind of, I'm going to butcher his name, Quentin Dupieux. I'm just going to say, I'm going to assume that's how it's pronounced. What is it?
I think it's Dupuy, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it could be right. But apparently this guy, which I didn't know, but I only knew of him because I knew he was always coming out with these weird films. I knew when his Killer Tire movie was released a number of years ago, Rubber, which I never got around to seeing, and I know was very divisive, which I imagine this guy, this is the only types of project he makes that are divisive. But apparently this director, he was apparently a successful French techno musician and record producer, and decided to go into the film game. So, I don't know. I think that maybe that says a lot about his projects. But, you know, essentially I'll get into this by saying, every once in a while, a film comes along that dares to ask the question, what if your deerskin jacket was the only jacket in the world? That's the question that this film poses. And you may be, like, just completely baffled by that. And you should be, but man, what an experience this is. It's first off, this is a very short feature, and I could have easily watched another hour of it, but, you know, it's kind of refreshing every once in a while to see a feature that just gets in and gets out and doesn't waste any time. You know, John Dujardin, who is most well known, obviously, for his lead role in the Oscar-winning The Artist, is, you know, really great as our protagonist. Essentially, he's a man on a mission after a break with his wife. And essentially, I'll give you the basic initial setup in the movie, and then we'll jump off from there. But essentially, we first experience his character driving around and then attempting to flush his regular measly jacket down a toilet at a rest stop. He's traveled out to the French country. You know, essentially he's answered an ad to purchase a deerskin jacket. And the old man who happens to sell him this jacket just so happens to throw in a digital camera for the hell of it. Our character checks into a hotel, and the rest, well, is history to say the least. And he goes on a very strange journey. But essentially, you know, he's becomes obsessed with this deerskin jacket, and throughout the process of the film is gradually picking up other deerskin items of clothing to complete the ensemble. But essentially, you know, there's these really weird moments. Essentially, early on, he goes to this bar, and he's the only person in this bar outside of the bartender who is talking with a woman at the other end. And he's so enamored with his deerskin jacket that they're talking underneath their breaths, and he butts in and he says, "Oh, do you like my jacket? Do you think it looks good?" You know, he's just so obsessed that he thinks everyone cares about his jacket. And like I said, he's sort of going through, you know, a break with his wife. So he's clearly just like, I don't know, he's turned the love for her to this jacket. You know, you could analyze it in so many different ways. But there's these really weird things. And essentially in that same part, and pretends that he's a filmmaker, and by doing so he strikes up this relationship with the bartender who just so happens to be a film editor, and essentially he's you know, his wife has locked him out of his bank account after spending an absurd amount of money on this deerskin jacket, so he essentially uses this bartender, you know, and her editing prowess for her money, you know, and just sort of, you know, decides to go around filming murders of himself, you know, doing all sorts of things to just random people in this deerskin jacket. He's constantly lying to her about, oh yeah, like obviously, like I said, he lied about being a filmmaker. He's just some guy, but he has a camera, so he can just say it. And he's filming his obsession with these jacket. He gets all these people that enter the ads, like to, you know, come, and he says, "Oh, you know, you're auditioning for this role. Well, bring every jacket you own." And then he just stuffs them in his trunk and drives away. So, because he's like, because essentially the main gist and his goal, you know, and essentially he and I know this sounds weird, but he and the jacket have the same dream. And essentially the jacket wants to be the only jacket in the world, and he wants to be the only one wearing a jacket in the world, because no other jacket compares to a deerskin jacket. And the best stuff in this film is the conversations between Jean Dujardin and the deerskin jacket. And essentially the director essentially films it like it's actually a two-person convo. So he just, you know, cuts from Jean Dujardin to the jacket hanging, you know, across the room, and it's just absolutely brilliant, and I loved every second of this film. There's even a moment where it's almost like, did the jacket become sentient or somehow? I don't know, like, it's really strange, but if this sounds like it's like you would enjoy this, I highly recommend it. I think it's really darkly funny throughout, and I've never seen a character like this or a film like this, and these are the types of films we need in the self-isolation era.
I think so. I think this is just the amount of insanity that I've been feeling lately. So this was pretty welcome. And, you know, my admiration for the film is maybe like a step or two below yours. Like, I really, really liked it, and I laughed my ass off through the entire thing. I really appreciate the brevity of its running time at only 76 minutes. But I found like the central conceit to be something that was very, very clever, but it never transcended that for me, even if the material and Jean Dujardin's performance did at times. And I think that for those of you who have only seen Jean Dujardin in The Artist, or even in Wolf of Wall Street, or any of his French stuff where he plays kind of like the French George Clooney in a way, this will be very different, and I think it can be lost on a lot of people just how good he actually is in this movie, because it is very, very subtle, and he's just like kind of balancing this like down on his luck guy with a charm and this admiration for a jacket. Like, to have full conversations with the jacket playing both characters alone, to be able to pull that off. First of all, this Dupuy really directs that scene well, using like the rack focus to go between the two, or even like the shot reverse shot. But the way that Dujardin just like kind of sells that admiration and that longing and that same end goal with the jacket, you feel it. And as he's doing increasingly terrible things, you're enjoying it. And, you know, you're not. Well, I mean, you're supposed to enjoy it, but you are rooting for him to get his comeuppance in the end. And, you know, I appreciate that the film keeps that line kind of, they walk that fine line, not necessarily between keeping him likable, but keeping him charming enough where you're not so repulsed that you want to turn away. But he just like has these one liners that are absolutely astounding. Like he keeps on, they always go back to the idea of like, check out my killer style. And like, he's telling one woman, a prostitute that comes onto him, he tells her off and he says, you know, you don't think I'm a real filmmaker? You don't like my killer style? And they just keep going back to that. And for some reason, that just fucking cracked me up every single time. There's a really great, like, little two-note music motif that punctuates when something really terrible is about to happen. And you see that look of desperation on Duchardin's face. Like, this is a really, really entertaining movie. And I do think, like, yeah, if the movie was longer, it probably, there is more they could have done. But I don't know. Brevity is a source of wit in this instance, I think. But and even like, you know, a lot of the editing is make sure that like even just in terms of, not even in terms of storytelling, but knowing when to end the scene and what scenes to kind of linger on. Like there are still plenty of shots of Duchardin just like sitting in his car looking sad. And they really underscore that isolation that he's feeling. But then it just goes fucking completely off the rails. And it's just so, so much fun to watch.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you're right. It doesn't like completely transcend the topic. It just sort of, like I said, it's just there and you just, you know, let the film wash over you and it doesn't strive for anything more than that. And I think you're right. If it was longer, it probably would have got into the nitty gritty, you know, a bit more, but I don't think the film ever intended to do that. And so I think it's just a really like a really strange portrait of this guy who's kind of, either he's lost his mind or he's just in a tough time in his life and he just strikes up this very incredibly strange obsession and you just watch him, you know, just watch his descent throughout the film. And then the ending was really, I won't give it away, but the ending was just, it was definitely very abrupt, but it almost certainly fit the project, to say the least. And also, I will say, I know this director has another film coming out, and I think the teaser just dropped, and it was literally, I think it was like 15 seconds, and essentially it was just a giant fly drinking out of a pool. That was it. And I forget what it's called, but you know, it just looks incredibly strange. And God knows, I think this is what this guy does. Obviously, he made a killer tire movie. He made a film about an obsession with a deerskin jacket, and you know, he's just gonna keep making these incredibly strange, weird things. And apparently, he didn't have to because he was a successful musician and record producer. So hey, you do you, man. You know, keep making this strange stuff, and I'm sure I'll be checking out some of his future projects and even some of his past stuff, you know, probably in the future. But with that in mind, Ryan's going to talk about our last film.
I'm going to talk about it very, very briefly because it's really just such a, it's a documentary. So you already know it's going to be horribly depressing. It is Welcome to Chechnya, directed by David France, who was also behind the Oscar-nominated doc How to Survive a Plague, which chronicled the HIV crisis in New York City, specifically in the 80s, and the lack of government response towards that. This is a different kind of governmental oppression that he's exploring. It takes place in Chechnya, and I won't go too far into specifics because it's just shitty stuff that no one really needs to hear right now. But if you feel you have the stomach for it, I do highly recommend you seek it out because it is incredible filmmaking. But it centers around this activist group that understandably keeps as low profile as possible. All the people, they're basically trying to smuggle queer people out of Chechnya because Chechnya gets its directives from Russia. And Russia obviously has a notoriously incredibly antagonistic and violent perspective on queer people. And, you know, they even go to the point where the people that they are helping get out of the country, they use like digital alterations on their faces just to make them, you know, look different enough. And we kind of spend some time with them. It's not like super hammy, but we see the relationships between the two. We see, two guys who are in a relationship who haven't seen each other in over a year, reuniting at the airport. And it's just such an understated thing because they have to hide the fact that it's a romantic relationship. And this is just, you know, some of the more, you know, smaller scale emotionally gut punching things. Again, I don't want to go into too much detail. I just want to give all the compliments in the world to David France for, first of all, highlighting these types of issues. I mean, How to Survive a Plague is a very difficult watch as well. But if you're into documentaries, I really do recommend you go out and check that one out as well. It's certainly a lot better than whatever the fuck you watched on Netflix in the past 3 months in quarantine. He just has like such a knack for filmmaking, and he knows how to, you know, raise the like, let the tension of the situation speak for itself. This is a very, very, very tense film, and we follow these people as they are, you know, basically about to get on the plane before, and I don't even want to go into detail about some of the suspense sequences. I hesitate to call them that because it is legitimately life and death matter on hand, but it's just, you know, they build it up and they really kind of hammer home. I think it just like hammers home the idea of how destructive it is to be a queer person in this country. And that's, it's really just a goddamn shame. And I know that this type of violent homophobia, transphobia, any type of anti-LGBTQ sentiment is still pretty rampant in other parts of the world. And, you know, goddamn it, I really hate this United States of America sometimes, but we, I guess in the grand scheme of things, we are a lot more progressive about this particular issue than a lot of other countries. And that's just sheerly through the will of the people. People were saying enough is enough. And, you know, the culture started turning gradually. And, you know, we got to a place where it got better and better. And there's still a long way to go, but we're getting there. And it's just really disheartening to see that other nations are just not doing that. They're actively killing people just for no fucking reason. And that's really upsetting to me. But David France is, you know, he's a fantastic filmmaker, and it's really, it's public service journalism. It goes beyond the idea of documentary filmmaking. He's telling a story that needs to be told and a light needs to be shined on this kind of issue. And, it, you know, it just so happens that he's a really, really great director too. And they're even like, he even knows how to pick his moments of levity in the film and the moments of humor so well to kind of just like, take the edge off even ever so slightly, because God knows you need it. But it's just, you know, it's on HBO right now. Everyone has someone's HBO password. It's a tough sit, and the world's on fire, and there's so much shit going on in the United States. And it's really hard to take on someone else's trauma when we're really trying to manage our own and processing everything on a daily basis. But maybe when you're feeling a little bit better, I really recommend checking this one out.
Yeah, and that's, it's for that reason that I didn't end up checking this out, but also because I ended up ending my HBO subscription a couple months back, just because, I mean, there's so much stuff to watch out there, I decided to just save a bit of money for a month or two. But also, obviously, this film seems like it's, you know, certainly doing, you know, well to bring, you know, to bring a new perspective and make sure people know these terrible things that are going on. I just didn't think my mental state could possibly take it, especially given, you know, being alone most of the time. So, you know, but definitely one to check out, as Ryan said, and obviously gets his highest recommendation. But with that in mind, we're going to transition to our new segment that we debuted in our last episode, which is our question of the week. And this week's question, which I came up with, was what film would you wipe from existence? And I think this is going to lead from existence, sorry. And what's, you know, I think this is going to lead to some interesting debate. But I'm actually going to open the floor to you, Ryan, first. And this is with a purpose and with a reason, because I'm expecting you to go a certain direction. And I think it will naturally, if you go the direction I think you are, not that I know the film, but certainly a certain direction that I expect from you, I think it's going to bleed right into my choice.
So this was kind of a tough one for me, because I ultimately have to do two. I don't know, like, what tone we want to play, particularly with this new question of the week segment, but I think we should play around with it. So I picked one kind of, I picked a serious one and I picked a silly one. I'll do the serious one first, and that is just for the fuck of it. I mean, there are so many I could have chosen, but this just happens to be patient zero for me for some reason. That is Clint Eastwood's American Sniper, starring Bradley Cooper. It is, I don't want to go like too far on a political rant, but the film has a lot of icky politics and a lot of brown people bad, white savior stuff. It's just like, it pisses me off. And I remember the furor about that film. And I don't know, it's just something that really rubs me the wrong way. And I know that, you know, Hollywood has to go through the Department of Defense. Like, the Department of Defense actually has a film wing or film bureau where they actually advise directors and movie studios about what they actually can and can't depict in their film, and how certain scenes should be depicted and how certain themes should not be explored. It's a really, you know, just keeping all that in the back of your mind, that is just something that sticks there. And then, like, just watching the movie unfold, you realize that, like, I don't necessarily believe that Clint Eastwood was being disingenuous with this, but I think there was just something going on there that was not working for me. So now I want to transition to kind of a fun one. And it is also kind of, you know, just melancholy if you're a film fan in general. And it's not going to be for the fucking reason all you smartasses think. I am going to go with Star Wars Episode One, The Phantom Menace. And it's not because of the quality. The film is not as god awful as everyone says it is. But it just really killed the box office. I mean, that's that kind of signaled to studios that the only way to go was to pump money into, you know, six or seven film series. And, you know, cinema was never the same after that. We got it's just, and, you know, as, you know, we were talking about earlier that, you know, things have been remade again and again over time. But, you know, there's just something really kind of garish about seeing these series that go on well past their expiration date. And I think that really can be pointed back to Phantom Menace. That's where, I'm not saying that's where franchises were born necessarily, but I think that's really where they started to be commodified, coming out of the screenwriting boom of the 1990s, that era where even someone like me probably couldn't have made it as a screenwriter. I mean, it's just, you know, I long for those halcyon days, and, you know, it could be, there is no shortage of great stuff out there for me to watch, but it's kind of like a grumble thing. And you just kind of wish that there was some kind of happy medium between, you know, super spectacle and intimate indie.
Yeah, no, that's two interesting choices. I certainly was not expecting that second one, for sure, especially because I know your thoughts. But obviously, I thought you gave a good argument. Like you said, it's not for the reasons everyone thinks. And I know your thoughts that you actually like The Phantom Menace sort of most out of the prequels. But I think you're right in that it definitely changed things, you know, for big blockbuster culture. And that sort of makes for a great transition into my choice. I don't know if I've mentioned it here in this podcast, but I know I've mentioned it to you, Ryan, of possibly what I consider my least favorite film that has ever been made. And it's a more modern film. This film was released, it is a blockbuster, it was released in the year 2009, and it's a little film directed by the one and only Michael Bay, and it is called Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. Literally, for my money, one of the worst films ever made. And that could be said of a number of Michael Bay films. But I think, you know, and what's interesting about this film is, you know, you could make the argument it was, you know, this film was in production at the time of the infamous writer's strike. But if I know Michael Bay like I know him, and I think it was Kurtzman and Orci who wrote the script for this, which I don't even have to say anymore. You know exactly what that means. But I think even if they had months to write this script, I can't imagine it would be any better. And it does sort of, I'll connect in some weird way to Ryan's first choice, although you might not know what I'm talking about until I get into it. But first off, you know, let's talk about this film for a second. We've got the great John Turturro. You know, throughout this series, whatever entries he's in, he's always really overacting to an degree, and who can blame him? Obviously, I don't blame John Turturro for a second. He's taking a paycheck. God knows he's earned it for the amount of great work he's done and the great amount of, you know, art films he's done. And so I can't blame him for that. But we have the great John Turturro looking up and talking about giant robot balls. We have the worst, most unfunny parents ever to be in a film. We have humping dogs. We have never-ending product placement. We have Michael Bay moving a camera virtually up Megan Fox's, well, you know what, it's what he does. You know, and then, you know, credit to her for leaving the series, you know, after this. I give her a lot of credit for that, because she couldn't stand Michael Bay's bullshit and objectification. But the worst element of this film, without question, is we get a pair of racist caricature stereotype Transformers. And these are two of the worst characters ever put on film. And it's just sort of, you know, it really shows, you know, especially when we're living in the era of representation, growing representation for many different cultures. And thank God, you know, for that. But it's just like shows just a complete tone deafness. And like I said, I worry that even if this wasn't written during the writer's strike, that it would still have, you know, terrible attempts at humor and probably fall into these really terrible caricatures. And, you know, I make no mistake about it. This film is absolutely one of the worst films ever made. And the fact that people actually, you know, enjoy these Transformers movies when it's just noise, convoluted robot designs, and, you know, everything that's bad, that's terrible about Michael Bay is just thoroughly depressing to me, and I think it stands for everything that is wrong in blockbuster culture. And so Ryan talked about sort of the beginning of modern blockbuster culture, and I think in many ways I think the Transformers series is the absolute worst, particularly this film in particular, the second in the series, for, you know, everything it represents, all of its content, its terrible attempts at humor, and all of the worst impulses of Michael Bay, which are on display obviously throughout his filmography, but they're at their absolute lowest here. But, you know, I just, you know, this was like, I was like, I came up with this question, and I didn't really think about it too much. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, well, this has got to be, you know, my choice for sure.
You kind of hit on an interesting point about like these blockbusters that, and obviously from, you know, bell to bell, Transformers is probably the worst modern series. But then again, there's so many other, and a lot of it, there were at least one or two good movies kind of peppered in. You think of stuff like the Harry Potter series or Pirates of the Caribbean series, even the Lord of the Rings series. But like there are some, but the majority of the movies within these series are fucking terrible. And I think that's it. That's where that disparity, that, you know, that love of 90s, even like 90s blockbuster filmmaking, even just thinking back to, you know, stupid shit like The Matrix, going back even further, Twister, Face Off, Con Air, Broken Arrow, Speed, all these like super macho, super dipshit action movies that was essentially my entire childhood. That's the kind of blockbuster filmmaking that, and this is just purely, please take this as exactly for what it is and just, you know, blah, 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 grumble, grumble, old man. But, you know, it's just, it was just kind of disheartening to see them go in that direction. And then these movies, like, yeah, we had some really shitty movies back in the 90s too, but time has been kind to those. I don't think time is going to necessarily be as kind to these blockbusters that have been kind of just shit out of Hollywood in the past 20 years.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely right about that. And that's the interesting thing. And, you know, I'm always like, and like you mentioned earlier in this podcast, you talked about, you know, the irony of our name, the death of cinema. And I think, you know, I'm certainly not one of those people, and I tend to see the positive side of things. And I certainly am not one of those people who think blockbuster culture has ruined movies. It certainly made it more difficult for these mid, you know, range, mid-budget, you know, adult films. But, you know, I've talked about on this podcast before at how, you know, if you think cinema is dead and you think there aren't great films out there, you're not looking hard enough. And yes, I certainly bemoan the lack of, you know, a budget for a lot of great filmmakers out there. But I still think there's always going to be good stuff to explore, and I think there's always going to be bad blockbusters. And I think they're, honestly, they're always have been, but certainly not to the degree that there have been in the past few decades in the commercialization of these types of films to the nth degree. So I think it's, you know, really interesting. And it's also, I have to say, ironic that we're talking about blockbusters right now in the summer of no blockbusters. So it's really interesting to think about it from that perspective, and obviously with good reason. But it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, I'm really interested to see what the market is going to look like, particularly next summer, if it's going to be completely stacked. We'll see if we're out of the woods even then. But it's going to be really interesting to see how this current point in time really affects, you know, the film industry at large, but also blockbuster culture at large. But with that in mind, I know Ryan has a question of the week ready for our next episode.
I know it's going to be hard to pick one, but what is your favorite original song ever from a movie? It doesn't matter if it was nominated for an Oscar or not.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think this is a really good pick. It's sort of, it's definitely a different direction. And like I said, I want this question of the week, like, we can touch on serious issues, it can be fun. You know, I think we did sort of both, you know, with the question of the week this week. So, you know, we're keeping it open. And obviously also we're open to suggestions if any listeners have any suggestions in the future that we could take under consideration. But obviously, as always, feel free to share your picks or things if you have anything strong to say about any of these questions we pose. But I think that's definitely going to be a fun one to explore when we get back. And speaking of which, you know, obviously throughout this past month we've missed a lot of the big releases, so our plans currently are to really do, you know, a big episode, you know, catching up on a lot of these big releases. So among them we have the great Palm Springs, which I was fortunate enough to get to see, which is currently streaming on Hulu. I got to see it last week, and you could make the argument that this is the movie of the summer, and I think I'm really excited to get into discussing it for sure. I think it's really fun and a breeze to watch. We also have Kelly Reichardt's First Cow, a filmmaker who's been making fiercely independent films for quite some time, and I know a film that's gotten some of the best reviews of the year. We also have the horror film A Relic, which I'm really excited to get into. We also have, I guess essentially this could be viewed as one of the blockbusters of the summer that's currently streaming on Netflix, The Old Guard, starring Charlize Theron, Chiwetel Ejiofor, among many others, from Gina Prince-Bythewood. I always forget how to pronounce her name exactly, but a filmmaker who certainly made her mark, and Charlize Theron is continuing her streak of badass blockbuster women that she gets to play. And then also we have the most recent release in the Dave Franco directed The Rental, starring Alison Brie and Dan Stevens, and I'm looking forward to checking that out, as that's also in the horror realm. So we're planning on just sort of diving into this big group of films, and we'll be back in another couple weeks, you know, when we digest all of those different films, because obviously we want to try and get to all these things we missed, and then we'll try and move forward into the dregs of August and see what else, what other random VOD films. And as we move into the fall, I know there's going to be some really good stuff coming to streaming services, so we'll see what we get into and go from there, I guess.
Yeah, again, Andrew, thank you for your patience in these past few weeks. And just like I said to everyone else out there, it's grad school. What the fuck else can you do? But semester ends this coming Friday, July 31st. I am going to the dispensary buying a full ounce of Skywalker OD and not leaving my couch. So I will bang these movies out as fast as I humanly can. But as always, thank you so much for listening to us, and we'll see you next week.